Hi, I'm Stargate Pioneer.
And I'm Steven Jondrew, and we're from Better Podcasting, a proud member of the Gunna Geek Network.
Just like the show you're listening to now.
The opinions expressed are those of the individual host.
Check out all the other podcasts at GunnaGeekNetwork.com.
And get ready, because geekiness begins in 3, 2, 1.
This is Paul McGann, the Eighth Doctor. You're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio. Go and throw yourself under a bus. I didn't mean to say that. He told me to say that.
Welcome to Gallifrey Public Radio, a podcast dedicated to everything Doctor Who. Join us each week for discussion ranging from Hartnell to Capaldi. I'm your host, Jay Witten. Did you just say womp womp? And my co-host, Haley Malley.
I like it with the helmet on.
And Keir Hansen.
And that's why, to this day, I can't eat cotton candy.
Spoilers.
We will be discussing news and rumors, as well as episodes that have already aired. But don't worry, if we get into anything too serious, we'll warn you again.
Welcome to episode 185 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where it's your last chance for Dodo, your last chance for Steve. It's a poor choice of dentist with an ace up his sleeve. It's a classic Hartnell episode with a horrible theme tune, but there's sure to be some shooting at the Last Chance Saloon. I'm your host, Haley Malley, who refuses to sing. And joining me this week in the GPR studios, we have Jay Witten. How are you today, Jay?
I don't know what to think. This was, yeah.
This was your idea, wasn't it?
Is that the Wizard of the Ivories, Jay Witten?
Yeah, something like that.
And we have Keir Hansen. How are you today, Keir?
I'm doing fine, but my tooth, I've got this thing. this week we decided we're going to sit back all comfortable-like and rustle up a nice glass of milk and enjoy one of the oddest classic Doctor Who stories imaginable, The Gunfighters. Complete with jailbreaks, questionable dental hygiene, your showdowns at the OK Corral, saloon piano sing-alongs and sing-alongs and sing-alongs and sing-alongs, and more Western serial tropes than you can shake a six-shooter at. So, this is one to enjoy for none of the reasons that you would typically enjoy a Doctor Who episode.
You know what I realized with this set of episodes is that the weird thing about the historical classic Doctor Who episodes is that there's nothing weird happening in them. It's just a historical event, and the Doctor showed up for it.
Right, right. And this one, you have to wonder, on a lot of levels, how much research they did other than just making None. Sure that they had the town and some names and fit it all in there. So, Donald Cotton taking the pen on this one and giving us a bizarre story. But I actually... You know, there are certain aspects of it that I genuinely enjoyed, aside from just the goofiness. But things like the Doctor passing them all off as a traveling musical troupe.
Mm-hmm.
And his justification. You know, how else is it? Are you just going to walk up to them and say, you're from space? Spaceman Steve? You
know? Yeah.
But it's good on them that they just all happen to be these crack pianists. And they can bang out a honky-tonk tune. But yeah, so general opinions. What did you think about the story overall?
It made me want to watch Tombstone. So it's that.
Okay, but not the Kevin Costner Wyatt Earp movie.
I don't think I've ever seen that.
You're just as well.
Okay.
No, I have a lot of fun with this episode. I don't know what it is about it, like, because I don't typically like westerns, which this very much is, but. There's just something about it. It's over the top goofball that just, I don't know. It pulls me in every time and I love it. Mm. It's not the music. It's definitely not the music. It's definitely not the,
to catch a tune.
It's definitely not the Western accents. If that's what they were,
really which come to. Out Australian half the time.
Oh God, it was so awful. But it's,
it was great.
It is fun. It's fun to sit there and watch because it is a story that you've kind of heard before. I mean, everybody's heard of the shootout at the OK Corral and things like that. And whether you don't know the whole story or you've just heard it referenced or things like that, it's something that you can kind of be like, no, I get that. I understand this name. It's Mr. Werp. But
but those are some of the things that you got to wonder. I mean, so we look at it with whatever, you know, we take our modern eye and we look at this and say, oh, okay, well, maybe they were going for the campy factor. Maybe they weren't. Maybe this was them putting their best foot forward, but they were just working in a genre that just wasn't comfortable for any of them, you know, and they had high hopes and this is what they ended up with. Like Werp, you got to wonder, was that something that Hartnell was just mispronouncing? Because he had a tendency sometimes to go up on his lines, but they'd somehow work it in or just ignore it. They'd never edit it out.
They don't have time to do a second take.
Yeah. Takes were expensive.
So, but you know, after he says Werp once or twice, everyone starts saying Werp and they have to actually work it into the script somehow.
But that was the thing that I liked too, is the fact that it's, you know, when Hartnell starts calling him Werp, like I really do think that was just him screwing up the lines. And it struck me as funny the first couple times, but then like, as it, like you said, you know, it keeps on going. And it's like, well, is it messed up? And then Steven says it later on. I think it's like in the third episode or something. He's like, you know, and then Werp, I mean, Erp. It's like, he stops and corrects himself. I'm like, if that's coincidence, that's brilliant. And if it was him just picking up on what he kept saying and playing with it, that's even better. Mm-hmm. Love it.
Yep. Well, there were so many things about this that, you know, even from, I mean, you knew where this entire thing was going from the conclusion of the first episode, you know? So after 24 minutes, you're like, okay, I know everything I need to know about this. And now I just want to see how they're going to roll with it, because it's about to get really messy, and I know the accents aren't going to get any better, and I know the set sure isn't going to get any better, and the singing is never going to leave me, and if I stop talking for too long, she's going to come up behind me and start singing right now. But there's the things like, you know, from the start, you know, I look at it, and you know, the doctor comes out, he's complaining about his toothache. If he had any sense of how to actually pilot the TARDIS at this point in his illustrious career, he would know that the worst place you could possibly go would be, you know, the 1840s mecca of dental surgery.
Yeah.
And that was the great moment. He plays it so well. Hartnell's just, you know, he's constantly kind of pawing at his jaw and such. And then when he is actually in Holiday's chair, he just comes at him with the rusty pliers and things. Don't you have any sort of anesthetic? I can hit you on the head with this gun. I just loved it.
Got some of this rattlesnake oil.
Yeah. But some of the things that I wondered was like, so you've got the... you've got this gang camping out at the saloon because they know all of the details about Holiday as far as, you know, rough description and his tendency to want to go towards a place where he can drink and play cards and swindle people. So they post up at the Last Chance Saloon, and Holiday's place of business that he's just opened up is two doors up the street. Two. And somehow eludes them. For who knows how long that they've been sitting there. I love the proximity of all this. And again, it's just like the Werp-Erp thing that you got to wonder. When the doctor finally comes in and he realizes the whole mistake in identity thing, he says, well, no, you're looking for Doc Holliday. His place is right here up the street. It's like they just keep pointing out these things that you've been screaming at the television screen for the last 15 minutes. So,
yeah.
Again, I have to wonder, was this all really that well done, tongue in cheek, and they just committed to it? Or was it this bad and you just love it because it's this bad?
Does it really matter, though?
No, not at all.
It's just as enjoyable either way. Like, you can play it however you want in your head, and it's still just as much fun because it is so completely nonsensical.
Yeah. But it's funny, you know, if you go and you look into some of the backstory of putting this particular story together, there's a lot of things going on. I mean, this is the first time the Doctor had an entire story that was based in the United States. He had visited New York City at one point briefly, but this was entirely set within the U.S., so that's mm-hmm. a bit of an adventure for them. It's the first, obviously, their first foray into doing anything Western, of which they did not do many, maybe because of how this one panned out. I don't know. You had Rex Tucker directing, who was going to be the principal director before Verity Lambert. So back in 63, he was involved in all the pre-production, and then they hired Verity, and she absolutely, you know, earned her cuts. So it gives Tucker his opportunity to direct. And I would say from a directorial standpoint, pretty solid episodes. I mean, pacing gets a little odd at times, but I think that's more just actors' choices and delivery over necessarily the way the shooting was done. Had some interesting angles, you know, some shots taken from, you know, second floor, you know, so we're breaking up that kind of a stationary two-camera layout. Again, by this time in this third season, we were seeing a lot more interesting camera work as their set got larger.
Mm-hmm.
You find out, actually, the guy who played Johnny Ringo, the original role was offered to Patrick Troughton.
Nice.
So imagine how that would have been. I mean, because I would say out of all of the guys that they cast, Johnny Ringo was probably one of the weakest, I felt. I just couldn't really tell where his accent was going. The way they wrote him is, you know, I never pictured you for a back shooter.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. It's just there's a lot going on here if you're willing to give it more time than just, oh my God, this is a horrible Western episode. I'm just going to fast forward through this. I'm going to get to it.
But if you fast forward, you missed out on the jaunty tune.
You do. You do. Poor Steve, forced to sing that thing over and over. I love his expression by the time he gets around to the fourth round of it, and he's just staring at the ceiling. It's a time for the... And Dodo's just loving it. She's just banging away, playing the piano. I was just getting to like this song.
Were they poking fun at themselves? Were they self-aware enough to do that?
I have to hope so.
Because I was thinking that 5 minutes into the first episode, I was like, man, they were playing this song a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's like they were looking through like five or six different songs. Like, why'd they have to do that one so many times?
Well, because it had the name of the saloon
right.
in the title. They felt that was so appropriate. But I don't know. By the time you get to the second story, the don't shoot the pianist, which was weird because at the time when that first comes up on the title credits at the close of the first episode, you think, well, Dodo's playing the piano. What's happening? And this is before we switch over and realize that Steve's a crack pianist as well. Who knew?
Who is it?
Apparently, everybody just knows how to play on a honky tonk piano. But how does Holiday keep sneaking in and out of the saloon?
Yeah.
Is he like going out the second floor, you know, doing a roof walk kind of thing that we just weren't seeing? Because I kept wondering. It's like a couple times he makes it in and out of the place. He's a dash hand.
He's coming in through the back door.
Well, I mean, you know, there's so many people in that saloon that come in and out of the doors. I mean, there's like a whole, like, you know, five.
Yeah. Well, this is a busy town. You know, there were no other until they go to lynch Steve.
Right. And then they've got like 27
people. They
were going
to shoot him anyways.
There was like nobody around, nobody passing by any windows anywhere, nothing. But all of a sudden, hey, there's a lynching. Everybody comes out. We're going to hang this guy in the funny Marty McFly costume.
Yeah. No, and that was the thing too, was it just, I know that law was a loose concept in the Old West, or at least that's, you know, how it's played up and stuff like that. But it's like, so you're going to go and stand in front of the sheriff's office and say, hey, you know what? We're going to straight up murder this guy if you don't get. And even though that he's got a gun pointed at you. Yeah, no, we're OK. Just go ahead and hang that random dude because, yeah, I'm not going to do anything. The heck.
But they didn't end up bringing him in on an attempted hanging.
You
know,
yeah.
Masterson brings one of them in.
No, we're going to kill this guy unless you give us that other guy so we can kill him instead.
Somebody's getting killed. Hand us yours or we're going to use this one. There were, I guess it's all of the jumping back and forth. I would say if I were just to critique anything, is just the fact that there were probably, if there weren't enough extras to kind of give the town some depth, and that might help with the fact that the sets, you know, every time somebody bumped into one, it wobbled like crazy. When when the bartender dies, when Charlie dies across the bar, I thought the whole thing was going to collapse.
That was so horrible.
That was scary. So we're a little worried about Charlie. Charlie! But if they had just maybe cut down on some of the Clantons a bit and had just some walk-on roles, just some people with a one-line or two just to get them in there. Mm-hmm. I think it just would have kind of balanced a bit, because between all the Clantons doing all their arguing, and then you've got multiple derps showing up, you know, and then Pa Clanton finally shows up in the third story, and Johnny Ringo shows up, and it's just getting more and more convoluted on the gunman side.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, there's the doctor who just wants to leave. I just love the fact that he's looking at this whole situation. He knows all of these people by name. Like, he knows the stories behind them. It was like back in the second story, the Don't Shoot the Pianist, where he finally hears that these are the Clans. He's, oh dear, I mean, how do you do? I just loved it. But between all of the back and forth, I think they probably could have condensed it or tightened it a little bit. Among the getting us up to the final showdown. Although, in retrospect, that probably would have meant that gunfight would have lasted 20 minutes instead of 10.
Oof, that was rough.
just horrible shots. The Clans are just horrible, horrible shots.
Seriously, I mean, these guys are all, like, you know, prime candidates for Stormtrooper Academy.
Masterson and Earp are walking down the middle of the street.
And they're, like, literally 20 feet away from them. Like, he says, shoot them, you know, start shooting when they're out of range. I'm like, I'm fairly certain your range is longer than 12 feet. Like,
as Ringo sneaks up behind. I guess, to a certain degree, you can just enjoy it for the schmaltz factor, and that's fine. But it's still, boil it down, there's still some really enjoyable aspects of the episode itself. I think the companions, I think both Dodo and Steve are rock solid on this one. I think probably because, at least initially, they're enjoying the fun of it, and then when it stops being fun, Steve's in his element because he's just kind of caught in the entire thing, trying to be helpful, but just trying not to get killed, because it's always Steve's head in the chopping block. Dodo, yeah. I feel bad for, because she spends so much time with Holiday, who's just a scuzzball.
And, like, I love the brilliant reveal that she's going to shoot him if he doesn't take her back. And then as soon as he agrees to, oh, thank God, I'm going to put the gun down. And he still holds to his word. I was like, okay, that's not something you'd expect to happen.
Honor amongst thieves.
Good for him. But, I didn't think that was going to work out.
I just think if I had to watch Holiday smack one more woman on the backside, I understand it was probably some sort of a period thing, but just guys, maybe twice to establish the fact that he's jerk.
He's a creep.
Yeah.
But yeah.
But to be fair, it was really only two women, wasn't it? Like, there were no other women in this. It was just Kate and Dodo.
That's right. Casting Palooza going on here. A lot of the aspects of it, especially down to the way the whole thing just kind of buttons up. You know, Holiday and Kate, arm in arm, off to another town. Earp has decided no longer to be a lawman. Shocker. Not really cut out for this business. And Masterson, who, you know, it's funny. I would say he's probably the most two-dimensional character out of the entire thing. They really didn't put anything behind Masterson other than the fact that when he steps in and says, well, I have to represent the law, and the law can't abide by this, so you're on your own to go commit murder. Bye.
There wasn't a lot of depth to him. It's just, oh, I'm going to be the moral compass just because, well, we need somebody to say something at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to change anything at all, but yeah, it's going to be the reason why we have only, like, you know, oh, that's what it was. They only had like 6 or 7 prop guns, and if they added somebody else to the gunfight, they did.
Do you bang, notice every bang. Once in a while someone would get their guns taken away, but then suddenly they appear in someone else's holster? Wait a second. Had a limited number of props.
That's why the doctor had to keep giving his back to Earp.
I loved, oh my god, the attempted jailbreak where he just hands the gun through. He's like, oh, I don't want this thing. Here, just
somebody
it
handed it to me.
People keep handing me guns and I don't want them. And you just said, what are you doing? He said, oh, no, that boy I travel with, he gave it to me. He's going to meet me back here in 10 minutes, he says. Oh, really? Oh, my God.
And then
is
the,
that
like,
where this is going?
When was it that you were going to try and break out? Oh, right now. And he just reaches down and unlocks the door and walks out like, what the hell? Crack security we've got here.
Yeah, I loved it. Well, I think to a certain degree, I mean, they knew they were keeping the doctor in there for his own protection. They kept hammering that point home. But, you know, it would have been even better if it were unlocked the entire time and he just comes out talking. He just swings the door open. Well, I did. I say, dear boy.
Although it did take me a little bit. I remember the first time I watched it, like, it took me a while to figure out what was going on because I couldn't tell if Earp was keeping the doctor in there for his own protection or if he was, like, trying to protect Holiday or, like, what the – because they never really said anything. They're just like, oh, no, we're going to take this guy in. Yeah, we've got Doc Holiday locked up. And what the hell?
Yeah.
But the part where the Claytons are explaining what's going to happen, like, you know, talking to Steven about getting the doctor out, and Steven's just completely going along with it, like playing it up like, oh, so you're not going to wait and shoot me in the back as soon as I do this, right? Okay, good. And they're like, yeah, no, we've got – like they think that they've got him completely snowed. And it takes the one guy to be like, I don't think that he really bought what we said. Like, you think?
I guess take it for what it will. I think it's one that bears watching. It's one that I don't know if you want to show it to people to say, look, there's times when the show doesn't take itself that seriously, or it might be something you want to present to people and say, this is how far we've come. I don't know, but
you know what it is. I mean, you've got the range of Doctor Who episodes where you've got, like, you know, the Caves of Androzani or the Day of the Doctor, which are like, no, you need to sit down and you need to watch this and you need to really enjoy the story that's being told. Then you've got the episodes like Fear Her, which are like, no, stay away at all costs. There's just nothing to be gained here. And then you've got these episodes, which are the ones like, you know what? I really want to watch Doctor Who, but I also want to get completely trashed and laugh at something. This is that episode.
Hand me that rattlesnake oil.
This is the one that you get drunk to and do riff tracks. That's how it works.
Oh, yeah. You probably could. Here's another little mind gem for you. So Anthony Jacobs, who played Holiday in this, his son is Matthew Jacobs, who wrote the 1996 Paul McGann film.
Oh, God.
Nice.
Yeah, because he actually brought young Matthew on the set with him. And that was like one of his first really big exposures to Doctor Who, and it stuck with him for that long. So,
and now we know why the 96 movie is the way it is, because apparently that's how it's supposed to be.
The story itself has been one of the most panned historically. For I guess, you know, depending on how you come at it, I guess you could say, oh yeah, you can go ahead and you can tear it apart if you wanted to. I mean, if that's the angle that you're taking, you've got plenty of ammunition to do so. But I think if you take the right spin on it and you appreciate it for its foibles, that we don't even know whether they were really mistakes or were they just so genius. You know, oh, no, I know we could probably hire one or two American actors, but nah, let's just go with it. See what they can do.
They do so good. They do so good with the spaghetti Western stuff. Let's try it the other way. Oh.
There were a couple of them. I was trying to figure out if the British accent going towards cowboy just produces Australian or if they had Australian actors in there, and I couldn't tell for sure.
No, I think it's when you just try to, when they tried to drawl.
That's
bit.
What happens.
Yeah, that's what they ended up with. But they were telling, and it gets worse when they yell. So when they're when they're talking up close with one another, they're okay. But as soon as they started to yell, it like completely went off the rails. Especially in the gunfight when they're yelling, and you got the Clantons, you know, yelling back and forth to each other, accents just went right out the window. You're like, okay, that's fine. I knew you were hiding it the whole time. Just go with it. I mean, if we can have, you know, we can go 10 million years in the future and they all have British accents, then so can the OK Corral.
That was the thing I remember when starting, it's like, what are they doing here? Because it really took a minute to like to get their Western accent or something and like understand it. So I couldn't tell. I'm like, are they trying Western? Are they just going to go British? Is this like a weird amalgam or what's going on here? And it's an acquired taste is what it is.
It is. But then again, you know, just think how poorly we have, you know, American actors have attempted other accents and done such a bang up job with them.
Sorry.
Well, so now you can safely say that you've made it through the Gunslingers. Unfortunately, the story that follows is one of the entirely lost stories. You do not get the savages, although Haley did notice. She's like, "Oh, look, more cavemen," but not really. They're not really cavemen. They're just uncivilized.
But those are clearly the exact same costume. I think maybe they shaved them a little bit.
Yeah, they brightened them up a little bit, put a little white paint on them.
But they're the same burlap sacks they've used for all of their cavemen.
Pretty much, yeah.
Oh, yeah. But it's fun to go back and watch this one every now and again when you don't want to take something too seriously. This is a good one to go back and hit because it's fun.
It is. It's straight up fun.
All right. We ready to jump into the news?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, a lot of our stories actually kind of hinge off of this primary item, which is the fact that the official Doctor Who magazine has finally hit its 500th issue. So kudos to the entire team. For everything that they've provided us, because the magazine itself, whether you are a current reader or you just like to go back and collect the archives and just enjoy all the great stuff back there since, 79? So, apparently, though, one of the best things, as we found in our circle, is that, as many times, there are a lot of freebies that come along with the magazine. Sometimes, over the years, it has been things like those little plastic pop-out records that you could put on a 33 and a third and so forth. There are, at times there have been, I don't know if they ever did Shrinky Dinks. They might have done Shrinky Dinks once or twice back in the 80s.
Yeah, I think that was, some of the earlier issues.
But this time around, they go with one of their standards. They go stickers. Stickers are easy to throw into a magazine, so and we all love stickers. But apparently... Not only are these just your usual kind of, there's a Capaldi and there's a sonic screwdriver and so forth, but there are actually Paul Cornell stickers. You can stick Paul Cornell all over anything you want. It's as fun as googly eyes. In fact, you can put googly eyes on Paul Cornell and then stick that on something else and then tweet him the results because I'm sure he'd love to see what we've been doing.
I'm going to do
adhesive likeness.
I'm going to order a couple of these magazines just so that I can stick Paul Cornell. Do like the surprise Nick Cage things, but do it with Paul Cornell instead. It's like somebody goes to get a jar of spaghetti sauce. Boom, Paul Cornell. Oh my God.
Well, unfortunately, for those of you in the UK, obviously you've got them. This came out for you late last week. We are usually here in the States on about a 3-week delay, so keep an eye on. I know Barnes & Noble tends to have them on the racks in limited numbers, so you might want to check now, at least check in with them and see if they can hold an issue for you. And then usually a couple weeks after that, you can grab one on Amazon, grab a onesie or twosie here and there. No guarantee as to whether or not we'll still have its stickers inside. But, the next item, though, that comes out of that, though, is that one of the things that came up in that particular issue is an article that I think has been a long time coming and has to do with Moffat's views on diversity for the program and where it's headed, both in his last year at the helm and what he'll be handing over to Chris Chibnall for the next series. This has been talked about quite a bit over the past week since the issue hit. Thankfully, the folks over Doctor Who TV and folks over at the Mary Sue have put the majority of the excerpts of the article out there so you can get a chance to look it over and kind of get a take for what he had to put forward in terms of discussing where the show should be, where it's in the pursuit of, what impact these efforts towards a truer diversity had played into the casting of Bill with Pearl Mackie. Did you folks get a chance to read this over?
Not in its entirety, no. I didn't get to.
One of us prepared for the podcast.
This time it was surprisingly Haley.
At least I was done watching before we started recording.
I thought one of the interesting things he said is it's not like they went out to just cast white people over the years. They were like, oh, we'll do racially blind casting and we'll naturally pick up a diverse cast. And then he was like, well, you know, what happened was we were casting from a source that might have been predominantly white. So, shocker, we got predominantly white actors. And one of the things they need to focus on or work on in the future is to look at casting in places that maybe they haven't typically gone to in the past to help diversify their cast.
And his one of the initial points that he had brought up in the interview was actually the fact that, you know, it's there are certain shows where you might say that a slanted casting. I'm not even going to say that it's a whitewash casting or anything of that sort, but anything where if you're doing a period piece that takes place, you know, somewhere in whatever, it's Iceland in the Vikings. 1800s. Exactly. You got Vikings, you're probably going to have a hard sell on going with a diverse cast unless you're putting characters in there just for the sake of, you know, and it feels unusual or shoehorned. With Doctor Who, because of the fact that you are constantly changing your location, constantly changing your temporal backdrop, you're constantly changing the scope of your primary, secondary cast and your extras, there's no reason, there's no justification whatsoever for not being as diverse as the world that you are conveying. I don't think he was in any way trying to explain away how things have been. But I think this is just a solid statement of the cognizance of where it has to go and the work that they're putting towards getting there.
He was acknowledging that, you know, maybe there had been a problem in the past, but it was something they wanted to work on. Another interesting point in this article was that they said they had offered the role of the Doctor to a black actor and that it hadn't worked out for various reasons.
Mm. Yeah, let the hypotheses abound.
Idris Elba.
One would imagine.
Also, Noel Clark was the first black actor to set foot on the TARDIS.
Mm, right. Yeah. So, it's, again, I mean, I think post-2005, the show has been improving exponentially. Mm-hmm. Because I think just within the last couple of seasons, you see a lot of ramp up in terms of the equality and neutrality. But I think it goes back to one of the things that Moffat has touted ever since he took on the showrunner's position. It has to be the right opportunity for the right actor for where the story is at the moment. You know, when there was the whole discussion about casting a female doctor, he said, I have absolutely no aversion to it whatsoever. Has to be the right time.
Yeah. And that, I mean, that's the thing that they've always said is like, we don't cast for, you know, race or sex or anything like that. It's just, we cast the right actor for the job. And, but like you said, I mean, this is a discussion that's going to go on until every single person feels like they have been represented. It's going to happen. And so we're never going to hear the end of this discussion.
Nor should we.
Mm-hmm.
Nor should we. Because, I mean, with a show that's built upon change and is built upon the opportunity of being that flexible and that malleable, the opportunities will come around.
Right.
And it's not a matter of rushing it. It's not a matter of saying, well, we've got a quota we got to fill. We got to check all these boxes. It doesn't work like that at all. But it's just a matter of no doors are closed.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a matter of, okay, these moments will arise and we will find the right person for the role at the time to suit the story, to serve the fans, to improve the show.
Right.
And be a good reflection of the world in which it conveys. So, the last item we've got here. Speaking of individuals, I know that we tend to poo-poo a lot of these articles about people saying, "Oh, sure, you know, if they asked me, I'd love to be on the show. I'd be the next Doctor because I haven't, you know, released a PR Newswire item in a while. People are forgetting about me, so I'm going to mention Doctor Who and get my name back into the limelight." Nothing of that sort. This one counts.
Yeah.
John Noble.
Yeah.
Walter. For those of you Fringe fans out there, all of us, basically, would you not want to see Walter just stepping through the TARDIS doors and just probably tripping on something. You know, he's probably, you know, hepped up on, I don't know, who knows what at the time. But wandering in there with a strawberry milkshake in his hand and just staring at the TARDIS interior. And just the camera just spins around and around and around as he's taking it all in.
That would, yeah, that would be something.
Yeah.
Although, I know. All right. So, Haley, you mentioned that you want to see him as the master.
As the master. I think that would be more entertaining than seeing him as the doctor.
Okay.
Wow.
Kier, do you have
any? Personally, I would have seen him if you wanted to bring the meddling monk.
Oh, my God.
Ooh, there you go.
Would he not be awesome?
That would be brilliant.
Think about him in Lord of the Rings, you know? So he's, you know, he can have the sinister side. He can be straight up evil if he needs to be. He can be dark if he needs to be. He can be conniving. And you had opportunities with Walter, too, where there were times when he had to be manipulative and things like that. But he's got that wry sense about him. I think he'd be killer. Plus, he'd be good age casting against Capaldi, too.
Right. No, see, me personally, I'd like to see him. I mean, fine. Say it's typecasting, whatever. I'd love to see him as, like, one of the scientific advisors to Kate Stewart in UNIT.
Just one of those guys in the background who's testing equipment for.
Yeah,
no, I mean, just keep blowing up back there.
I mean,
it's like the guys behind Q. Bond is like, oh, don't pay attention to what's going on over there. We're working on some new exploding pens, and some guy runs through with his lab coat on fire. Almost got that one worked out.
I mean, you can give him a part. Like, actually, he could actually be part of the story and everything like that. But I mean, you could basically have Walter in Doctor Who. I mean,
yeah,
it would be the perfect way to just say, hey, you know what? Here's this character that you know and love, and here's the validation for putting him in here.
Yeah, they come across some villain they haven't encountered in 30 years who's encased in amber. Oh, well, who do you call on? But yeah, having him as UNIT's quartermaster would be amazing. We'll put that out there. So listeners, chime in on this one. So if you were given your opportunity to say where John Noble would land for a supporting role in an upcoming Doctor Who episode, would you want to see him as the master, taking nothing away from Gomez? This is we'll jump times. All right, we'll get ourselves clear. So he comes up against another iteration of the
master. My God, no, multi-master story. Holy crap, put him against Gomez.
And then John Sim in the background. I'm still relevant.
Firing lightning off.
I should have never worn the hoodie. Okay, so you've got a potential master, you've got the monk, or you've got essentially UNIT's Q.
Yeah.
So
or if you've got
all of them. It'd be like Krieger clones. You just have them everywhere.
He plays everyone except for Capaldi and Bill. That'd be great. Oh, God.
I like it.
Yeah.
But they come to a planet of John Nobles.
Oh, man.
That's a good note to end on right there. Definitely, I think so.
All right. Well, this has been episode 185 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, GPR was here. And now it ain't.
And this is Kier saying, this podcast is fast becoming prey to every cliche-ridden convention in the Whovian podcast circuit.
And this is Haley saying, oh, Johnny, I apologize. I forgot you were there. You may go now.
We'll see you guys next week.
Alon Z.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook @facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Gallifrey Public Radio is copyright 2016.
This was GPR you're listening to. Now it's over good. We're all going back upstairs and getting drunk like we should. I got lyrics I didn't write down. I should have done them in advance. But that would mean I'd go upstairs. I'd have to put on pants. Something.
It's time for a hoedown.
They did not have one hoedown.
Oh, no.
Not a single person do-si-do'd in that entire episode.
I mean, they had Dodo
dodo'd. Dodo did Dodo. This was a much more solid episode for Dodo.
Yeah, no, it was. Like, she actually served a purpose here.
Yeah. Even though she got trapped upstairs in the hotel for like 35 minutes.
Yeah.
She didn't even want to play cards. What horrible card game were they playing? They're just laying all these cards down on the bed, and Kate slaps. Oh, you slapjack. Got me again. It's a slapjack. 52 pickup.
Oh, no. It was fun, though.
Yeah. We should probably mention, if we're going to put this in the After Dark, hey, for those of you who are going to be listening for next week, we're going to be talking about life on Gallifrey and how much we actually know about the social structure and all those good things. We tried to tap in on this once before,
mm-hmm.
and realized that we just didn't have enough televised at the time to go on. There's a lot in the audiobooks and novelizations, right. and things, but now we've had far more.
Oh, hey, there's another good casting thing for John Noble. Just random Time Lord douchebag that's, you know, antagonist to the Doctor.
He could be Navin.
Or he could just be Razzalon.
We've had enough. I'm up to here with Razzalon.
Yes. So
okay.
There's other times.
Bring back Omega.
Oh, God. Oh.
John Noble is Omega.
That would be brilliant.
He finally just takes off the helmet and it's just him all along. Did you miss me?
Or
he could just come in and play Walter meeting the Doctor.
Could you see the Omega mask with that little mouth slit and a red Twizzler as he's trying to eat one?
No, bring back one of the Guardians. Like, throw the big old bird on his head.
Oh, yeah. He could be the slightly gray Guardian. Just got this owl kind of hanging slightly crooked.
Captain Jack's father.
Oh, wow.
Who's Captain Jeff.
No, that's one thing we should bring up. There was a little trailer that was going around.
Oh, yeah, the fan-made thing.
Yeah.
Well, apparently good enough to confuse a lot of people.
No, it took some digging to find out that it was actually fake, but there's something going around saying, like, you know, this Christmas on Doctor Who, and then it shows Captain Jack saying, "Did you miss me?" And then the BBC One logo and everything like that. And it was convincing. Like, I had to do some digging before I found out that it was fake.
Well, I just figured when Barrowman tweeted and said, "Yeah, that's not me," you're talking to the wrong person, because people were saying, "Oh, is this real? Is this real?" He's like, "Don't tell me. Just you go talk to the BBC. I'm ready. My bags are packed. I kept that bag over in the corner,
right
next to my other four bags for the other shows I'm waiting to be on."
It's like, I've got all my coats arrayed right there by the door, just so I can grab one and go.
Not that bag. No. That's Underoos. Don't touch that bag.
Oh, so that's his con bag.
Yes. That's all it has in his underoos and red heels. Oh,
God. Sadly, no, that sounds about right.
Yep.
If you've ever been to a con that John Barrowman is at, you know what superhero underwear he was wearing that day.
Mm-hmm. You can actually tell. You see the photos and you say, "Oh, okay, that was Dragon Con 2014. I was there." Oh, that was San Diego. Okay, yeah, that's right. You can tell by which superhero he's sporting.
Yep.
All right. We good to wrap, kids?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
All right. Got a lot of homework to do for next week, yep. So.
We'll see you guys then.
Cheers.
Bye.